Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Well, it's not just Friday, it's follow-up Friday. And as we did last Friday, we will follow up now to dig a little deeper on some things that came up briefly on the Brian Lehrer Show this week. We'll get to things about Iran, about blogs, and more. But we begin with the unusual spectacle of a spat involving web video between filmmaker Michael Moore and Republican presidential might-wannabe Fred Thompson. As you may know, Michael Moore has a new documentary coming out this month called Sicko, about the U.S. healthcare system, in which he praises Cuba for having universal health coverage. At least I hear he praises Cuba. I haven't seen the movie. Well, here again is the sound from the 30-second video that Fred Thompson posted on YouTube about that.
You know, I've been looking at my schedule, Michael, and I don't think I have time for you. But I may be the least of your problems. You know, the next time you're down in Cuba visiting your buddy Castro, you might ask him about another documentary filmmaker. His name is Nicholas Guillen. He did something Castro didn't like, and they put him in a mental institution for several years, giving him devastating electroshock treatments. Mental institution, Michael, might be something you ought to think about.
Now, if you want to actually see that video, it is one of our video picks this week. Go to WNYC.org and click on Brian Lehrer Show to see all five of our weekly video picks, including that and some Michael Moore. And with us now to follow up and dig a little deeper on Moore versus Thompson is Slate.com's chief political correspondent, John Dickerson. He posted his own video on Slate to explain the spat. Hey, John, welcome back to WNYC.
Hey, thanks for having me back.
So how did this get started?
Well, it's the video was actually the third round in the back and forth. Fred Thompson, who is basically a gonna-be presidential candidate, he'll announce formally in July.
He's graduated from might-wanna-be to gonna-be.
He's raising money now. And in May, early May, he wrote a piece called Paradise Island for the National Review Online, in which he dinged Michael Moore for taking ailing workers from Ground Zero into Cuba for this film. Then Michael Moore came back in a smart move and challenged Fred Thompson. And in the challenge, he cited the fact that a profile of Thompson in which it was written that Thompson enjoyed Cuban cigars. So Moore, dinged Thompson for hypocrisy. How can you be against Cuba and still enjoy their cigars? And so in this long letter, he challenged Thompson to a debate. Thompson, in that video clip that you played, begins it chewing on a cigar.
Right.
And he has subsequently told a reporter for the Weekly Standard that that he's not going to give up his Cuban cigars, which were a gift, so he's not buckling on that either. This, of course, was great for Moore. It got publicity for his
a gift. Now let me just stop on that for a second. In order for the Cuban cigars to be legal in the United States, would somebody from another country have had to buy them originally and then give them to Fred Thompson as a gift?
I'm not positive about that. I think it is possible for you to accept them as a gift, even if they were purchased by someone else. But don't hold me to that.
Just not as a gift from a lobbyist if they're worth more than $75.
Well, he's not actually an elected official, so he can accept huge, massive gifts. And
good point.
It doesn't matter anymore. And also he could argue they were pre-embargo cigars, although that would
make them like really old cigars.
Yeah, that would be quite a gift indeed.
I'm not sure anybody would want to smoke cigars that old. And actually, Fred Thompson could have given them as a lobbyist, because that's one of the things he did.
That is one of the things he did indeed. So this spat, though, Thompson was only too happy to get into this fight because among Republicans, there's no greater villain perhaps than Michael Moore, and they love this Thompson's kind of joining the battle, and it was a nice little way for him to get himself some publicity as he was mulling his presidential run. The video came out a couple of weeks ago.
Now, in your video, you call this back and forth a play fight. What do you mean by that?
Well, it's sort of a fake fight. I mean, nobody, Moore didn't expect Thompson to embrace his offer for a debate. So it was everybody was having a publicity stunt here, and Thompson engaged this fight with Moore, knowing that if he wanted to build support among the Republican base, you can attack Michael Moore or maybe Jimmy Carter, and this will get you applause from conservatives. So in this case, it's an attack on Moore and a sort of sideways attack on Fidel Castro. So Thompson is throwing out a little red meat and. So he's choosing here. You know, Michael Moore's trip to Cuba is not among the most important
political
items
of our day.
Exactly. Although what is also sort of a play fight here is the underlying issue is quite serious, which is the American healthcare system, which Michael Moore takes on in his film, which I haven't seen. So I don't know whether it's fair or not, but certainly they could all, if they were having a real fight, have said, "Oh, let's
talk about the healthcare system."
Actually, talk about healthcare.
And Thompson certainly hasn't gotten to that yet. Certainly doesn't in this video, and hasn't gotten to it in his going to be presidential campaign. Well, but except for one thing, he brings a mental institution into this video. It's funny, but it sounds like a creepy threat.
Well, it's not a, it's a dinner speaker threat. It's a joke line, and it's not there's no real menace in it. It's just a sort of har har sort of line. And again, the enemies of Michael Moore, all of whom are would vote for Fred Thompson, would find that line particularly amusing and demeaning of Michael Moore.
So that's again, the Thompson side of the play fight. From the Moore side, he's just as happy to have the publicity for his film.
Sure. Yeah, I would. I think so. To have the hottest thing in Republican politics right now going after him, not only probably amuses Moore's fans, but it all gets all of us talking about his film, which gets publicity for the film, and perhaps even might make us all think about American healthcare someday down the road when the film comes out, if it's gotten enough publicity to be a part of the conversation.
All right. Again, if you want to see web videos posted by Michael Moore and Fred Thompson, they are both among our online video picks this week. Go to WNYC.org and click on Brian Lehrer Show. And for good measure, we have added a link to John Dickerson's video explainer of all of this on Slate.com. He is Slate.com's chief political correspondent. Thanks a lot.
Thanks a lot.
And speaking of politics, here's something I'll be doing next week that you may be interested in. I will be interviewing Democratic presidential hopeful John Edwards one-on-one at the Great Hall of Cooper Union. This is part of the series they're doing, letting candidates go into real depth on selected issues. So Edwards will give a speech for about 45 minutes. I think it's about poverty in the middle class. And then I'll do a 30-minute follow-up interview with him on the topic. That'll be next Thursday night, June 21st, at the Great Hall of Cooper Union in the Village at 6 o'clock. It is free, and they let people in on a first-served basis. So thought you'd like to know. It's Follow-Up Friday on the Brian Lehrer Show. We're following up to dig a little deeper on some things that came up briefly on the show this week. We will follow up now on two comments by U.S. senators that we aired on the show about Iran. Maybe you heard this on Monday from independent Connecticut Senator Joe Lieberman.
I think we've got to be prepared to take aggressive military action against the Iranians to stop them from killing Americans in Iraq. And to me, that would include a strike over the border into Iran, where we have good evidence that they have a base at which they are training these people coming back into Iraq to kill our soldiers.
That was Lieberman speaking on CBS Face the Nation. He does want U.S. military action against Iran now. And here is Republican Senator Sam Brownback from last week's Republican presidential debate on CNN on how else the U.S. might influence Iran.
I think we have to confront them aggressively for what they are, which is the lead sponsor of terrorism in the world. I think we need to push the sanctions forward more aggressively. I think we need to work with the labor union movement that's developing inside of Iran. You had a bus driver strike that recently took place.
Labor union movement, bus driver strike. interesting. We were going to talk about this last Friday, and then something came up and we couldn't do it, so we'll do it today. Two very provocative statements, and with me briefly now to follow up on them, is Vali Nasser. He teaches about Islam and the Middle East at the U.S. Navy Postgraduate School in California. He is also a Council on Foreign Relations Fellow and the author of three books, The Shia Revival, his latest, The Islamic Leviathan, and Democracy in Iran. Vali Nasser, welcome back to WNYC. Hello from New York.
Hello, how are you? Thank you for inviting me.
First, on Senator Brownback's remark, I was fascinated by his belief that the labor movement in Iran is good for democracy or for our influence there and presumably bad for the mullahs. Is there a labor movement in Iran?
Not in the sense that he's mentioning. I don't know of any organized labor movement. There are labor disputes all the time in Iran. The country has many economic problems, and periodically there are teacher strikes, labor strikes, driver strikes. These are not new in Iran, but over the past 10, 15 years when we've been seeing these repeated, they have not gelled into either a labor movement or a democracy movement. And moreover, we have a great deal of problem when we don't have any presence on the ground in the form of an embassy. It's very difficult for us to gauge whether these strikes mean anything, who are their leaders, how can we help organize them. I mean, none of that is quite possible with remote control halfway around the world without having ground presence.
You wrote a book called Democracy in Iran. Do you think these individual labor disputes that you refer to have any potential to help spread democracy in Iran?
I think generally there is a lot within Iran that suggests that there is a good promise for democracy, but it may not happen in the short time frame that the resolution of the nuclear dispute or the Iraq security issues would require. I mean, democracy has its own gestation. It may take time. The pro-democracy forces, the youth, the middle class, the private sector have to organize, have to be able to put together a credible political campaign, and have to be able to sustain a political movement against the regime in Iran for a period of time. And we don't see evidence of that. What we see is periodic bursts of unhappiness here and there that are either brutally suppressed or just wither away. We don't see a sustained campaign in Iran. And it's very difficult for us to help make it sustainable without having direct contact with it, which means having presence in Iran.
What was the bus driver strike that Senator Brownback was referring to? Do you know?
Well, all of these problems in Iran comes from the fact that there is a great deal of inflation in the Iranian economy, largely due to sanctions and mismanagement of the Iranian economy, the prices of material that people buy to live. Price of housing, price of gas, price of food is going up, but salaries are not necessarily keeping up with it. And once in a while, you have this blowover where demands for better wages, for better working conditions are not resolved properly and burst into the street in form of demonstrations and the like.
You know, it's funny to me about this. Here in New York, when the transit workers went on strike, politicians considered it a threat to public safety. In fact, it was an illegal strike for exactly that reason. And certainly Republican politicians in the state were railing against it the loudest. Any idea if Senator Brownback would consider mass transit strikes a good thing in the U.S. or only in Iran?
Well, we look for any kind of a signal of unhappiness with the Iranian regime as a potential of a beginning of the end of that regime. And we've seen many of this come and go. We don't know whether a bus strike will actually become a broader labor strike, will become a democracy movement. There is no evidence that that is likely to happen. The Iranian regime is quite brutal, is quite capable of suppressing opposition quickly and ruthlessly, and on occasion is also able to buy off its opposition. In other words, it can very easily give something to the bus drivers to make them go away. And labor disputes everywhere, including in the United States in the West, are not necessarily pro-democratic, and they're not necessarily supported by the wealthy, by the middle class, who, are, if we're going to have a democracy movement, have to come out and support the labor.
Does the Quran say anything that any side construes as implying any kind of labor rights or relations between employers and employees?
Yes, generally Islamic law favors that the labor be treated fairly, that it be compensated immediately, that it be compensated justly and in accordance to the skill and effort that the laborer puts in. But that's obviously very subjective. Like any legal system, it comes down to how the courts or the different parties interpret the word justice.
We'll continue in a minute with Vali Nasr, Iran expert, and we will move on to Senator Lieberman's call for attacking Iran now. We'll ask, first of all, whether it's well confirmed that Iran is actually training people inside its country to go to Iraq and kill Americans. And we can take phone calls on either of these things, the labor movement in Iran as a possible in for U.S. influence, per Senator Brownback, and Joe Lieberman's call for military strikes against Iran because of their involvement in Iraq. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, or post a comment on our website. Go to WNYC.org and click on Brian Lehrer Show. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. I mentioned earlier that I'm going to be doing this Cooper Union thing next Thursday, interviewing John Edwards at the Great Hall after he gives a speech, free and open to the public at 6 o'clock. You'll just go there and get in line. That's the way they do admission for those things. I should also mention that besides Cooper Union, this is organized by former Governor Mario Cuomo. Cuomo and Newt Gingrich decided together that there just isn't real debate in this country. There is, you know, these terrible 90-second soundbite kind of pseudo-debates on television, and they want the opportunity and wanted to create a forum for real in-depth discussion and debate on the issues. So they started the series with Cuomo and Gingrich going one-on-one. That happened recently, and they're going to continue it by inviting, I guess, all the presidential candidates. And Mario Cuomo will be there to introduce John Edwards next Thursday. And we just found out that today is Mario Cuomo's 75th birthday. So, Governor, happy birthday. All right. And some of you can see him there if you come to that event next Thursday at Cooper Union as he introduces John Edwards. This is Follow Up Friday on The Brian Lehrer Show. We're following up to dig a little deeper on some things that came up briefly on the show earlier in the week. This is a little experiment that we're doing over the next few Fridays. With me right now is Vali Nasr. He teaches about Islam and the Middle East at the U.S. Navy Postgraduate School in California. He's also a Council on Foreign Relations Fellow and the author of three books, The Shia Revival, The Islamic Leviathan, and Democracy in Iran. And we played the clip of Joe Lieberman from earlier in the week where he basically said the United States should attack Iran now. Vali Nasr, is it pretty well confirmed that Iran is training people inside its country to go to Iraq and kill Americans?
Well, I don't know about whether it's actually training people within its own country, but definitely Iran is involved in supplying arms and money and political support to militia groups and activists in southern Iraq. And this has been going, obviously, for a long time, that the Iraqi militias and the Iraqi politicians and many activists in southern Iraq do rely on Iranian support.
And who are those people? Are they Sunnis, Shiites, Al-Qaeda? Do you know?
No, primarily they are the Shias, particularly the Mahdi Army and Muqtada Sadr, but also some groups such as the party Skiri and its militia Badr Corps, which are actually the backbone of the Maliki government. They are also Iranian clients, and they receive support from Iran. But, you know, within Iraq, what Senator Lieberman is saying is a sense of frustration with the fact that the security plan for Iraq is not bringing that country under heel, and that not just Iran, but the number of Iraq's neighbors through sending of foreign fighters and funding and weapons to Iraq to all sides, the Sunni side as well as the Shia side, and Iran included, are undermining the security plan. The problem with bombing Iran as a solution is twofold. One is that it's a clear escalation of the Iraq war beyond Iraq's borders. This is somewhat like in Vietnam, extending the war into Laos and into Cambodia. Mm-hmm. And the problem with that is that then that might lead to Iranian retaliations, which would expand the scope of the war far beyond Iraq. And the second problem is that whereas we have had a lot of difficulty with al-Qaeda forces and also the Sunni regions of western Iraq, by and large, the U.S. has not had much of a direct challenge by the Shia population in southern Iraq. There has not been a Shia insurgency, even though there have been attacks on U.S. troops on and off by Shia militias. An expansion of the war with Iran can very much inflame southern Iraq, which is the largest portion of Iraq, with the largest portion of the population in Iraq, against the United States. And that actually will make our presence in Iraq completely untenable. We are able to stay in Iraq largely because the majority of Iraq's population, which is the Shias and the Kurds, is not actually up in arms against us. And most of the killing in Iraq by the Shias is of the Sunnis. That's where the majority of their focus is.
Now, this is so interesting because the paradox that you're laying out here is that those Iraqis who the Iranians may be helping to train are people who are actually associated directly or indirectly with the Maliki government, which the United States is trying to support.
That's been the problem. That's been the paradox from the very beginning, that actually United States moderate Arab allies have no interest in the Maliki government and do not actually support it and have not really been supportive of the United States in Iraq. And ironically, the politicians and the parties that we're relying on in Iraq, most of them spend their years of exile in Iran. They look much more favorably on Iran than they do on Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Syria, or Egypt. They have cultural, religious, financial, political, and in the case of the Sadrists and some other militias, also military connections with Iran. And this is a paradox for the United States, and also the fact that it's very difficult to manage Iranian involvement in Iraq, not just because of a common border, but also because of the depth of these relationships that have existed, that it's not easy through a single measure of bombing within inside Iran to get Iran out of Iraq. It actually can have a blowback effect of destabilizing Iraq much further, as well as if Iran retaliates in any way, then it will compel the United States to expand the war with Iran, which would make then the war, not just the war in Iraq, but would make it the war in Iraq plus the war in Iran, which is a major calculation for the U.S. military in terms of its capability to wage two wars at the same time.
My guest on WNYC is Vali Nasser. He teaches at the U.S. Naval Postgraduate School in California. We're following up on these two items about Iran that came up briefly earlier in the week, about Iran's labor movement, such as it is, and about Joe Lieberman's call for the U.S. to attack Iran now because of its involvement in Iraq. And we have some phone calls coming in on both of these things at 212-433-WNYC. Haydar in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Good morning.
Morning. How you doing?
All right. What's up?
Well, I just wanted to call in. I thought, first of all, I want to thank you for even raising this question about the labor movement in Iran. It's definitely refreshing to hear that it's being talked about, and it's surprising that it's coming from a senator in Kansas, Senator Brownback, I believe you said, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So, well, it as awkward as it seems, I'm going to have to disagree with my fellow Iranian and sort of push the issue that Brownback is saying, and that the labor movement is definitely political, in my opinion. And I think that there actually is a lot of evidence suggesting that it does have a potential for democratization and pushing Iran towards more of a democratic society. For instance, if you go to the web, you'll see that there are several pretty official websites dedicated to the movement, the labor movement in Iran. One of them, for instance, can I say it?
Mm-hmm, yes, sure.
For instance, you can go to IranianWorkersBulletin.org. There are various issues, up to 12 issues right now, about the plight of trade union leader Mansour Arslanlu, who is the executive committee, who heads the executive committee of the Syndicate of Workers of Tehran and Suburbs bus company. And this guy was arrested, and his family was harassed because, you know, they were creating a problem for the Islamic regime. When you look at something like that, and you say, well, look at Iran, look at the context, obviously they see it as a danger, I think that means it's political. Anytime the state steps in and says that, you know, you can't do this, this is a threat to the way we do things, whether it's about, you know, women's rights or humans' rights.
Or labor rights. Let me get a response to you. What was that web address again?
That web address was Iranian Workers Bulletin, one word,
.org. Workers Bulletin. Okay. Vali Nasser, what do you think about his take on this?
Well, I mean, as I mentioned, that the Iranian regime has a great deal of capability to be quite brutal with its opposition. And we've seen that they've dealt very severely with many labor uprisings in the past 5-6 years, including a teachers' uprising, which happened about 2 years ago, that was brutally suppressed. Again, a number of teachers, much like these bus drivers, were put in prison. In every country, obviously, whenever you have socioeconomic grievances, you have labor riots, you have labor organization, in the United States, in Europe, in any third world country, it is obviously a political issue. The question is, in what time frame might these turn out to change the political scene in Iran? And we don't know that. We don't have a gauge on that, particularly because it's very difficult for the United States to have direct relationship with the labor leaders, with the labor organizations and the like. And there are some problems because of the nature of the Iranian regime and its ability to suppress its opposition for labor movements to translate very quickly into broader social movements. One hopes that obviously they would trigger a much broader democratic movement in Iran. But in the past 5 or 6 years, they've been suppressed. And because economic conditions in Iran are dire enough to cause economic grievances to emerge. But so far, these sparks, these sporadic fires, have not caught on to become to engulf the entire regime and bring it down translate into a broad movement.
I just want to mention that I went to IranianWorkersBulletin.org. It's a real website, and it's a real dissident website. Issue 12, April 2007, exclusive interview, trade union leader Mansour Osanlu speaks. Labor activist Mahmoud Saheli imprisoned yet again. February-March issue, special report on teachers' protest. Thousands of teachers protest in Tehran. Brutal crackdown of teachers' protest. And the subtitle of the website is In Defense of the Labor Movement in Iran. So interesting stuff. And Haider, thank you very much for calling us. And we're going to move on and take one more phone call real quick. Jim in Union City, you're on WNYC. On the Lieberman thing?
Yes. Zbigniew Brzezinski last night was suggesting that it wasn't so much to destabilize Iraq or to support the Shia, but that the United States was actually supporting an insurgency in the Baluchistan region of Iran.
Do you know anything about that, Vali Nasser?
There has been reports of this, and a Pakistani intelligence general told ABC News that they have been training Baluchi insurgents, which is an ethnic minority in southeast Iran, in an insurgency within Iran. And this has been, one can say that already there has been a proxy war between the United States and Iran in the region, where Iran supports anti-American forces from Hezbollah, Hamas, the Sadrists in Iraq. And the U.S. has also been supporting, not only has been trying to weaken Iran in Lebanon among the Palestinians, but has also been supporting ethnic uprisings in Iran among the Kurds, the Azeri population, but most militarily, and the most brutal one is among the Baluchis in southeastern Iran, where there's been an insurgency going on for the past 2 years at least, which has led to major direct confrontations between Baluchi guerrilla forces and the central government in Iran.
We just have 1 minute left, but you teach at the U.S. Naval Postgraduate School in California. I realize your expertise is not military strategy per se, but is there buzz around the post-naval graduate school of the U.S. Navy that you've heard as to what this Lieberman-style attack on Iran might actually mean militarily? Would carriers from the Navy in the Persian Gulf then be attacked in retaliation, or have people been wargaming this as far as you know?
I don't know directly, but I'm sure that, you know, the U.S. Military prepares all kinds of plans for all kinds of scenarios. and all kinds of outcomes. Not that we can always know 100% how the Iranians might react, or may they react at all. But obviously, an understanding, you don't need to be in the U.S. military to assume this, that once a direct military strike happens on Iran, then you're in a completely new scenario where essentially it's the beginning of a war with Iran. And it can very quickly escalate into something bigger. And then you have to be prepared to contain and deal with an Iranian retaliation much more directly. And therefore, there is no such thing as hitting Iran one time, hitting a few camps within Iran one time, and then assume that that would be the end of it. Mm-hmm. That without a doubt, once you take that step, then it is a step into entering a whole new phase of the war, both in Iraq and also in the region.
Vali Nasr's latest book is called The Shia Revival. He's previously written The Islamic Leviathan and Democracy in Iran. Thanks so much for coming on with us.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Follow-up Friday continues. We will revisit a comment that Pete Hamill made here this week about how blogs could never substitute for newspaper columnists. Then we'll talk with a Brooklyn blogger who's not so sure. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. It's Follow-Up Friday. We're following up to dig a little deeper on some things that came up briefly on the Brian Lehrer Show this week. And now we want to look at something that came up in my interview with newspaperman and novelist Pete Hamill. You may remember Hamill was here on Monday to talk about his novel set in 1930s New York. The book features a lot of stories of immigrants surviving in the city back then. And we got to talking about how newspaper columnists like Hamill and Jimmy Breslin used to tell that kind of story of the individual immigrant, and that you don't really see their like anymore. In fact, Hamill singled out one reason for this that we thought deserved a second look. Here's what he said.
One reason for it is the overdependence on the internet. In other words, to sit in a building and call up all the various statements from politician X or Y or Z or think tank A, B, or C is not the same as going to 116th Street and seeing the changeover from Puerto Rican culture to Mexican culture, for example, it teaches us.
And he went one step further, directing his criticism at blogs.
Yeah, blogging, you know, the blogosphere. And when I teach at NYU, I try to tell these young potential journalists, don't waste your time with blogs, because you need to be somewhere where there are editors, where you're getting paid. The blog might be useful therapy, but it's not, at this stage of its development, journalism. And I think that is a big mistake to be doing that kind of stuff.
Pete Hamill here on Monday. So joining me now to look at whether the blog can tell the same stories as the newspaper columnist, and with a different take on it, is a local blogger. Bob Guskind writes the Brooklyn blog Gowanus Lounge. He also used to work in the print world as a writer for the National Journal. Bob, welcome back to WNYC. Hi there.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for having me on. Great to be back.
So you're a local blogger. Would you say that you and other bloggers can tell the same kind of story that print columnists like Hamill or Breslin are known for?
Well, you know, I agree with the observation that there are not a lot of people doing the kinds of writing that Mr. Hamill and Jimmy Breslin and Murray Kempton did, and those people are masters of their craft. But you know, it's not an either or kind of thing. I think that bloggers have a very important role to play, that bloggers are telling some very valuable stories, and I couldn't, with all due respect, couldn't disagree more strongly, with what Mr. Hamill said about blogging.
Well, is it conceivable for the blogosphere to produce its own Jimmy Breslin or Pete Hamill, you know, the way he characterized the life of the blogger? is that, here, I'll find the quote, you sit in, well, basically, you. Oh, here it is. You sit in a building and call up the statements from politician X, Y, or Z, or think tank A, B, or C. It's not the same as going to 116th Street and seeing the changeover from Puerto Rican culture to Mexican culture. So this image of the blogger is somebody who just sits in your living room and grinds out your opinions. Do you think that's overstated?
Oh, I think it is overstated. I mean, there's a measure of truth to it, but a lot of us are out there doing reporting. I'm out there all the time working on stories and not just depending on what I see online.
And tell our listeners what Gowanus Lounge is, for the most part.
Gowanus Lounge is a blog that covers Brooklyn pretty widely, and I cover a lot of quality of life and development issues and try and cover what's going on in our neighborhoods. And, you know, frankly, the reason I began doing it, you know, you mentioned that I'm from a print media background, mm-hmm. is that I wanted to take the journalism skills that I had and use them in this newer medium called blogging, because there are a tremendous number of stories on a daily basis in New York City generally, but in Brooklyn specifically, that Mr. Hamill's print colleagues aren't getting to. A lot of that has to do with space and resource constraints. But, you know, if 5% of the stories worth covering in a borough like Brooklyn are covered in the print media every week, you know, that's probably on the high end. So without the people, you know, who are out there blogging, a tremendous number of stories just wouldn't be told at all.
Now, we are going to open our phones and comments on our website on this. Listeners, what blogs do you read? And do they tell individual stories, or do they just spout opinions? 212-433-WNYC. Really, call us and tell us what blogs you read, especially local blogs. Do you read blogs that enlighten you about New York City? We read Gothamist. We read Gowanus Lounge, a bunch of other things around the office here. Curbed, a great real estate blog. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, or post a comment on WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show, 212-433-9692. Hamill said it takes someone to be on the payroll of a newspaper with the guiding hand of an editor to get the kind of portraits that come with shoe leather reporting. Were you surprised he talked about the importance of an editor?
Not really. You know, having an editor certainly helps, but also, you know, I mean, I agree with him to the extent that we should all be on a payroll and be getting paid for what we're doing, but I think that's where my agreement stops. I mean, to some extent, we're freed of the constraints of the newsroom and, you know, the things that go along with that. You'd be surprised if you knew how many, not large numbers, but, you know, I get calls from reporters passing along stories because they're frustrated in the newsroom environment that the stories aren't going anywhere. So, you know, while there are a lot of positives to having an editor questioning you and directing you, there are a lot of things, you know, about being freed from that top-heavy newsroom environment that promote creativity and allow stories that otherwise, you know, would kind of get stuck in the system to bubble to the top.
You know, I invited listeners who read blogs. I neglected to mention listeners who write blogs, like Louise in Brooklyn. Louise, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hi. This is Louise Crawford, and I have a blog called Only the Blog Knows Brooklyn.
Only the Blog Knows Brooklyn. And what do you write about?
I write about life in Park Slope and the surrounding environs, other neighborhoods nearby. I write about what development, real estate, culture, interesting events, parenting, sort of anything that might be of interest to people who live in these parts.
Right. You guys know each other?
Very well.
Yes, we do.
And I read that Brooklyn is by far the bloggiest borough of New York City. There are more
blogs.
Right. Somebody, you know, I guess checked out the ISP numbers or whatever and figured out that there are many more blogs emanating from Brooklyn, and Clinton Hill is the epicenter. than anywhere else in New York City.
That was Stephen Johnson Berlin, who has a very interesting site called outside.in, and he did the research and found that Brooklyn is the bloggiest. And we're probably the top 10, but he put Clinton Hill at the top and then gave some other cities a chance.
So why do you think Brooklyn is so bloggy?
The number of blogs or the amount of blogging tends to coincide with the rate of change in a community or in a neighborhood. And I think in Brooklyn we've gotten to the point where there's a critical mass of blogs. In other words, one blog inspires another blog, 10 blogs inspire 5 more. And, you know, pretty soon you get to the point where, you have dozens of them and you know, several of them in individual neighborhoods kind of competing with each other to get the stories out.
Luis, thanks a lot for calling. Keep getting those stories out. And Amy in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Amy.
Hi, Brian. I don't understand why Harry Hamel would assume that bloggers that are holed up with their computers all day in little apartments or something and aren't actually going out to whatever neighborhood and seeing what's going on. Well, they are. They're seeing it. They're blogging it. A lot of them are posting pictures they took with their digital cameras.
You got to go out in the real world before you can post a photo, right?
Exactly.
I mean, I guess you could shoot your cat, but... So what blogs do you read?
Mostly, I know a number of people who have live journals, and they're all over the country, and some are in other countries, and you really get literal
live journals. Is that a type of blog? A live journal?
It's a host for one type of blog or online journal.
Oh, that's okay. Bob, you want to elaborate on that? Is that the name? LiveJournal is the name of a blog hosting site?
Yeah. Those are tend to be the very personal kinds of blogs. I mean, blogs come in all different shapes and forms, and some are very personalized journal types of writing, and others cover neighborhood news. Yeah, I think one of the things that this all represents is a real democratization of the journalism process. And, the fact is that one of those people in a bar that Mr. Hamel might have written about years ago can now, should he choose to and be a little bit computer savvy, sit down and have his own blog and not need a columnist to filter his thoughts or to tell his story to the world. He or she can do that himself or herself.
I could think of a couple of recent examples of that where even blogs and then the traditional media wind up working in synergy with each other. Look at the Red Hook taco stand story that's in the Times as an example of the effect that blogs can have. Lots of local blogs registered their disdain at the idea that the stands could close thanks to the city's bidding process. And there was a blog set up also immediately after the print story came out called Save Soccer Tacos or something like that.
Yeah.
So that's one example where, the one puts it on the radar screen of the other. And I know you've been focused on the role of blogs in the Atlantic Yards controversy, right?
Absolutely. In Atlantic Yards, I think the Red Hook is a perfect example of that, and I can, point to another half dozen or so examples in the last couple of weeks where stories began reverberating around the blogosphere and were picked up, by our colleagues in the print media and got even wider attention. But yeah, Atlantic Yards is a perfect example of it and a perfect example of where bloggers have really, done the nuts and bolts coverage. There's a lot of information and knowledge that's out there about that development, whether you favor it or not. That wouldn't exist without bloggers out there working really hard to get the news out.
Here's a blogger and blog reader, Charles in Manhattan. You're on WNYC. Hi.
Hi. Thought that what Hamel was saying is nobody is Pete Hamel. That's what he was saying. And the other
No, he wasn't just being egotistic. I mean, you know, I despite the fact that we're taking on his comment, I love Pete Hamill, and he does unbelievable work.
He does. He's a fabulous writer. I remember there was an article in the Columbia Journalism Review about the, you know, the column wars when Jerry Nachman and Pete Hamill and Jimmy Breslin were all writing columns, and it was magnificent writing. They're the best. Now, the point is that at that time when Hamill was a great columnist, and there was, you know, few better, that you did it in the newspapers. But now there are some marvelous writers that are writing blogs, and they don't need editors. They're self-editors. I was a professor at the University of Missouri School of Journalism. I have a blog. I don't think I need an editor. Occasionally, I might. But, you know, we know how to write, and, you know, we want our opinions out there, and we don't want to go and you know, be interviewed and try to be hired by a newspaper.
Charles, thanks a lot for your call. A couple of comments coming in on our webpage. This one says, I read Gothamist, Gowanus Lounge, and my neighborhood blog, Clinton Hill Blog, all for quick local updates on every kind of thing going on around me. I also have my own blog about New York City and Brooklyn pizza places, for which I actually have to go out and eat at before I post. And someone else wrote, when I heard Pete Hamill say that about blogging, I thought, I did not know dinosaurs could talk. Ouch. Let's see. Should we get another one in here? How about Elaine in Helmeta, New Jersey? You have blogs in the Helmeta area?
Not really.
Not local
but I
blogs.
I just wanted to put in a word for national blogs, which are so important. You know, we would never have had the U.S. attorney scandal on the front pages if it hadn't been for Talking Points' memo that doggedly pursued this story until it became so obviously scandalous.
Well, let me ask Bob Guskin's opinion about that, because Bob, you used to work for National Journal, yeah, one of those Washington-based political publications. Do you think that's true, or would The Nation or, you know, one of the other existing liberal print media publications have likely smoked that out?
I think in that case someone might eventually have smoked it out, but the blogs made the story come to the surface faster. That's the sort of story that's so prominent that it eventually would have been smoked out and would have made it into the media. But I think that, you know, the blogs hasten the process of all that happening in a lot of cases.
And they keep stories alive.
Absolutely.
Is there a class issue here? Do blogs only empower those with access to computers and the internet and miss the stories of those less affluent, the very kinds of things that Hamill and Breslin and Kempton went out to report on? Because I think some of the demographic analysis of why Brooklyn is so bloggy is that it does tend to concentrate in the gentrified areas.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that really is a shortcoming. You know, I mean, I would hope to see more diversity among bloggers in terms of race and ethnicity, in terms of socioeconomic class, in terms of neighborhood location, to see more longtime residents rather than new arrivals blogging. You know, we're all creatures of our background. And I cannot write from the perspective of a Latino resident who's lived in Brooklyn his whole life. So it would be wonderful, and I think we would all benefit if more people from different backgrounds did start blogging. I think if there's one valid criticism you can level, that's certainly right at the top of the list.
Bob Guskin writes the Brooklyn blog, Gowanus Lounge. We'll finish this part of the hour by reading one more comment posted on the website that says, bloggers are like CB radio enthusiasts who've latched on to a passing fad that will be relegated to novel obscurity soon enough. I don't think so. But Bob, thanks a lot for coming on.
Thank you for having me on, Brian.
So it's Follow-Up Friday, and finally, there's one more thing. On Wednesday, we interviewed Professor David Brotherton, a sociologist from John Jay College who studies gang activity in New York. We took a call from a police officer, John from Westchester, who disagreed with Brotherton's characterization of the Latin Kings, which led to the caller exchange of the week.
The entire aim of the organization in New York City at this point is to make money, and the way they make money is through the sale of drugs. And you know that. There is no credence to this social organization whatsoever. Can the professor please tell me what they have ever done to further the cause of Hispanic culture or help the inner-city youth?
Well, they've done actually quite a lot. Again, you know, when we spent time with them...
Give me one concrete thing that they have done.
Well, they used to hold, for example, on a regular basis, what they used to call cultural classes on a Saturday morning in the Lower East Side.
Hang on, officer, hang on. You'll get your chance, officer. Go ahead and finish, David Brotherton.
They would talk about Puerto Rican history. They used to have a check on the amount of kids going to school, and they used to have what they called a law, which all kids of school age would go to school, and they would promote school and so on and so forth. I mean, there were all kinds of things that was going on in the late 1990s.
Do you agree, officer, that that might have been going on as well?
You know what? Because they had taught a couple of classes on Puerto Rican heritage and Latin heritage, they may have done that, and I'm sure they did. The other way you look at that is that's a recruiting tool. I mean, you can't honestly say this was an academic class they taught. No, it wasn't.
And working to keep kids in school?
What were the kids doing in school, Brian? They were tagging lockers with Latin King symbols. They were walking around with Latin King colors, and they were getting into fights.
John, thanks so much for your call. I really appreciate it.
No problem. And Professor Brotherton, I did enjoy your class, so...
a former student, Professor Brotherton. And there's the punchline, our caller exchange of the week, concluding our Follow-Up Friday segment for this week. Have a great weekend, everybody. Brian Lehrer on WNYC.